there's nothing quite as wonderful as the sound of a baby's laughter. And we all know where babies come from, don't we?
Okay, Shauna, good girl. And a big push again now. Come on, Shauna. Big push.
Keep going.
Okay, Shauna, come on. Come on, girl. Shauna, stay with us now. Come on, you're just there. Come on. Shauna, push for me now. Push.
Big push.
Oh, well done.
Right.
716.
Congratulations.
Look at your baby, huh? Well done, Shauna. Look at him. He's gorgeous.
That's right. The stork brings them.
I definitely heard that story many times when I was a kid, but I was also always very interested in birds from a very young age, so I just knew that that could not be true. But it is very interesting just how prevalent that story is. I mean, people in Ireland don't believe it, but we know that storks bring babies. It's we ask people about storks, they'll say one of two things. They'll say storks bring babies, or that's a type of margarine. That's the way we view them in Ireland.
This is the sound of the white stork, or more accurately, the sound of a pair of white storks, greeting each other at their nest. Storks don't really have any voices to speak of, so they communicate with each other by rapidly opening and closing their long beaks, making a clapping noise. It's a familiar part of the summer soundscape in towns and villages across much of Europe, but unfortunately, not here in Ireland. As Niall Hatch explains.
We've never had storks in Ireland. We get them as vagrants occasionally, but it's never been a part of our avifauna. They aren't birds that nest here in the way they do in Central and Southern Europe. It's not a bird that people associate with the landscape. So it is very interesting that somehow this tale about them bringing babies has spread to Ireland, just as it did in places like Germany and Poland and in Spain. So it's very prevalent, and it just shows, how this bird has become iconic. We know that the stories about storks go right back to Greek and Roman times. There are many fables and tales about them. They've been associated with fertility, perhaps because of the links with the harvest. Maybe that's where the idea of the babies come from. Also, storks would have been known as mysteriously appearing. Before people understood what migration was, the storks would be there during the summer throughout Europe, then they would completely vanish, and then they would reappear. And it probably made sense for people who didn't want to go into the realities of where babies come from to say, oh yeah, the storks bring them. Same as way some people would say they come from under the cabbages.
Niall is a member of the steering committee that runs Spring Alive, the BirdLife International project to monitor white storks and other widespread migrant birds across Europe, Central Asia and Africa.
For a lot of kids in Ireland, they wouldn't really have a clue what a stork is. The closest bird that we have in Ireland in terms of appearance would be the grey heron, which is a long-legged, long-beaked bird with a very long neck. But in fact, herons and storks aren't very closely related at all, and the stork indeed is a much bigger bird and tends to be in drier areas. So it's very much associated with things like corn and wheat fields, the edges of marshes and wetlands all across Europe, and it really likes warm weather. So that's one of the reasons why we've never had them breeding here in Ireland. It's just not warm enough for them. It's a warm weather-loving bird.
Now, the stork, we're told as children, that brings the babies, is it the white stork or the black stork? Because I know there are two species in Europe.
That's absolutely right. Yes, there are several different species of stork around the world, particularly in tropical regions, but there are only two species in Europe. And it is indeed the white stork that's said to bring the babies. It's not true. But that's the way the story goes. Because that's the stork that people were accustomed to seeing in their towns and villages. It would turn up in the back garden. So it made sense that it would bring the baby with it. The other type of stork, the black stork, it's almost in some ways like looking like a white stork in a negative image. It's got black on the head, black on the arm, to much of the body, and there's white underneath the wings. So it's quite different to the white stork. It tends to shun people, though. They nest, especially in the western parts of Europe, Spain and Portugal, they nest in cliffs and remote areas like that. As you move further east in Europe, they tend to nest inside remote parts of dense forests. So completely different habitat to that favoured by the white stork. So the two species actually rarely meet each other, except sometimes in migration, somewhere like Gibraltar or Tarifa in southern Spain, where they gather together in big clouds to migrate across to Morocco. That's when they might interact. But through most of the breeding season, they're in completely different areas. And black storks really don't like to be around people. They're much shyer. They're more solitary as well. You'll get many pairs of white storks nesting in the same village in sort of loose colonies almost. Black storks don't do that. They're much more solitary, tend to be tucked away in the forests. So the places where you do find them, they tend to have warm summers and cold winters, which is why the storks leave.
Gleis, Rhein, Einfahrt, RE, Zwoll, Nach, Wismar, über, Nauen.
I'm on a journey to the Brandenburg region of northeastern Germany, and specifically to the ancient pilgrimage town of Bad Wilsnack, located roughly midway between Berlin and Hamburg. Bad Wilsnack is famed for its religious relics, its spas, and its combination of late Gothic and Renaissance architecture. It is also home to around 2,500 people. But I'm not here to meet them. I want to see some storks. Thorsten Engelbert is manager of the local information centre.
Welcome you to Bad Wilsnack. I'm very glad that you are here to look for our storks.
Mm-hmm.
We have two storks in our small village, but there's a lot more in Rüstedt. And if you would like to go there, I can show you the bus. It's the bus 960 that goes directly to Rüstedt.
How long should it take me to get there?
About 15 minutes by bus.
15 minutes. Is it a regular service?
It's our regular service, yes. A very few times a day, but a regular service.
A scenic 15-minute ride on the local bus alongside roads lined with mature trees takes you from Bad Wilsnack to the much smaller hamlet of Rüstedt. Just 240 people live in the village, which in summer is also home to one of the highest densities of nesting white storks in Europe.
Hi, Dad. It's here. I left my mobile phone at home, so I have no idea whether you've tried to contact me already.
Yes, and I'm just trying to find the stork club.
Can you see the church?
I was at the church. I was standing at the church where I got off the bus at the bus stop, and I have walked down toward the nature park, perhaps.
That's cool. I'll find you there. See you in a bit.
The storks' nests are enormous. Essentially, massive bundles of sticks the size of tractor tires adorning rooftops all over the village. And so important is Rüstedt for storks that it has been designated an official European stork village, the only one in all of Germany, and a key part of the European Stork Village Network, which spans 15 villages in 15 countries. I'm here to meet Carola Benson, a member of the local stork club, and who, like most people in the village, is extremely proud of these birds. I'm Derek. It's very nice to meet you. Thank you for seeing me.
Yeah,
very
that's
much appreciate
cool.
It.
Oh, yeah,
are you
definitely.
From here?
No, I'm not originally from Rüstedt. I grew up about 2 hours away from here, but I've always felt attracted to this place. But
why?
Then it was storks.
Storks.
And also, I think it's, I don't know, I quite like the rural setting. I like it being close to the River Elbe. I think it's just beautiful. And really, it's a very nice village in itself with the red brick buildings and... It's just lovely.
I noticed a plaque on one of the buildings which dated back to 1883.
Right.
So, I mean, as I look around me, though, all of the buildings are beautifully preserved, but I'm just wondering, are they all that age?
Definitely, yeah. They used to be. Maybe we can just go and have a look at it together. There is still a castle building which is now being used as a wellness hotel, but that was a proper castle. And this whole area where we are was part of the castle grounds, and that dates back to... 17th century, thereabouts. And these villages have a Slavic origin before that, so they all stem around, 17th century.
But it's so picturesque. It's like something you'd see on a postcard. The church, the little kirk there, directly opposite the bus station, and the bus shelter, everything in red brick, and plenty of green spaces, and narrow roads. But I was quite impressed by the actual quality of the road service on the way here.
It
and the
is.
Road is raised.
Yeah.
So are they floodplains
yeah.
from the River Elbe
Absolutely.
That are on either side?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. All of the roads are built on a level, and they were built, I can tell you that, because our neighbouring village, that's where I live, we had a 700 years anniversary last year, so we did a lot of research.
Oh, okay.
So these roads were built 1902 to 1906, and they've all been built and put on a little dam in order to allow passageways through, so in case of floodings. We've got the River Elbe over there, but then there's also a smaller river called Katane, and I'm sure you've crossed it on your way here. And the Katane is lower than the Elbe, so the water presses into the Katane when the water rises in the Elbe. Basically, the water level raises of the Katane, and then it comes flooding in from the back, actually. So it's not just that the Elbe is a threat to us, but also the Katane, at the back of our villages.
Well, let's say the river was always there.
It was.
You put yourselves here.
That's true. And
if you know what I mean.
Yes. And the river has changed its course quite a few times. Mm. So places like my village, Belo, has actually changed its setting 3 times already.
Really?
Yeah, seriously.
How far? I mean, how much has it had to move?
I think just by a kilometre or so.
It's hard to believe, though, isn't it, that a town can actually move a kilometre?
Well, a town, let's say a little village.
So you must know everybody, do you?
A very small village, yeah. I don't know everyone here in Rustadt, but I know everyone in my village.
Well, talk to me about Rustadt. What does the word mean?
Stadt is just a place.
Yeah.
And they believe it stems from just Ruhestätte, Ruhe meaning quiet, or as a last resting place. So they think the names derive from Rustadt being the resting place, so cemetery place, for the family of Quitzo. Quitzo used to be a very famous family here in medieval times. So this is
where they bury their dead.
Yeah.
And mentioning the road that's raised and put on a kind of dam-like structure so you can have passageway and the rivers on either side, it creates the perfect habitat for storks, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, definitely the wetlands. That's the habitat that the storks need, yeah, definitely. What you can probably see on that map is that between us and the Elbe is a lot of wetlands. And it's those wetlands on the one side that give a lot of feeding habitats for the storks. But then on the way to Bad Wilsnack, the way you just came, there is a lot of arable land as well. And I heard some mowing going on. I don't know whether you saw
I noticed some tractors, okay.
Right,
but on the main road.
Oh, okay. So they must have worked somewhere. This is the map I'd like to have a look at. So they must have worked somewhere right now. I could just hear them, which means there'll be a lot of storks in the droves, basically, coming into feed.
So what are they feeding on in there?
At this time, when the earth is dug up, it'll be mice, it'll be all sorts of insects, that's probably more in wetlands, frogs and...
Even snakes, I believe.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Have you got any snakes here in this part of Germany?
Yeah, we do. We get a lot of, I don't know the English name, the one with like a yellow collar around its neck. Yeah, that's a very common one. And actually, I remember I once watched 2 young storks fighting over a snake. And
pulling
they
it
both,
from either end.
Exactly. They both had a bite of it, and it went on for 20 minutes or so. It was amazing.
But these aren't poisonous snakes, are they?
No, they are not. No, we don't. In this particular area, we don't have.
So they're like grass snakes.
Yes, I think that's the name, actually, grass snake.
Yeah,
yes.
I think so too.
But just to give you an idea, so we've got the setting of the village here, but actually the River Elbe goes in a big bend around the village. So that means between the village and the actual river. And the river has got a lot of, what are they called? Old arms of the river that's now like cut
tributaries, we call them, yeah.
Yeah.
Little branches off.
Exactly.
Yes.
And also little pools here and there. And so that's where you find a lot of aquatic wildlife. So that's a great feeding area. So that's heading that way. But it's having both options. Like I said, the arable fields on the other side, sort of more inland. That's also good for feeding. So, and we've got this, that's something that Rustadt has managed to do very well. They've got a good arrangement with farmers so that the fields can be mowed at certain times of the year, so that whenever there is a food shortage, and this year it has been...
And there goes another tractor.
There we go. And this year it has actually been... Hey!
Hello.
Hi, John. Tag, Jan.
Hello. Hello, how are you?
Hey, where were we?
You were talking about the farmers. The arrangement
with the farmers is such that if there is a shortage, for instance, then people can call the farming cooperative and say, we need an area mowed now because the the storks are starving.
And will the farmers do it?
They will, yeah.
Very good.
Yeah,
and it suits them?
Yeah, it does, not always. I mean, they want to make a living too, so it is sometimes difficult.
Well, do the farmers receive any payments?
No, they don't.
Nothing at all. So this is all good community spirit.
It is.
In the interests of conserving nature.
Definitely.
So the storks are very important to Rudstadt and the other outlying villages.
They are, definitely. I mean, from a touristic point of view, they are really important. But also for the identity of the village. They've been here for donkey's years, really, the storks. So I think people are, it's very much in their sort of cultural mind. People are waiting for the storks to arrive. And when the first storks come, you can tell there is a, storks are back.
So there is a sigh of relief
Definitely, yeah. And also there is a sense of sadness when autumn comes and the storks are leaving.
You're making me feel sad.
It's
already having that impact on me, I have to say. Because when I came in on the bus, I took the local bus, and I saw, just as I came into the town, I saw storks.
All right.
And I was so excited.
Yeah.
It was extraordinary.
It's great.
Just to see you.
Yeah.
Such a large bird on a rooftop.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not from Germany. This bird has come all the way from Africa, which is a long way away.
Having said that, yes, Africa is a myth in parts as well, because they don't all travel to Africa. So some of our storks only come from as far as southern Spain or so. So I don't know whether you've heard about it. There are two different
Two flight paths, yes,
that's
as I understand
right,
it. Yeah. So your birds here, which way are they coming?
Both, actually.
Both, okay. So you are getting some birds from Africa.
We do.
Presumably you have ringed some of the birds, so you know exactly where they're going to and where they're coming from.
Yes.
Show me a stork nest.
I was
looking at two when you called me earlier, and I had to drag myself away, but I want you to take me to the best nest site in Rudstadt.
Okay. Let's go there. Let's do it.
The white stork is a huge, rather imposing bird, standing around 1.1 metres tall and with a wingspan of over 2 metres. Males and females look identical. Their bodies and long, snake-like necks are pure white, as are the front halves of their wings. Their flight feathers, however, are jet black, giving the bird a striking two-tone appearance. They stand on extremely long, thin, red legs, which match their long, pointed red beaks. The general appearance of the white stork is very like that of a large white heron with pied wings. But in flight, it is easy to tell the difference once you know the secret. While herons fly with their long necks tucked in against their bodies, folded into a tight S shape, storks fly with their necks fully outstretched, their long red legs trailing well behind their white tails. It sort of makes them look like a long pale stick with black and white wings. White storks are highly migratory, with most of the population spending the summer breeding season in Europe, then migrating to sub-Saharan Africa to wait out the Northern Hemisphere winter. But in recent years, it looks like a major behavioural shift has begun, which climate change may well be driving. Niall Hatch.
White storks were always strictly summer visitors to Europe. They would spend the summer here in Europe, they would breed, and then they would migrate down to Africa. Now, for centuries, people didn't know where they went to. They would just vanish and then reappear. People didn't understand the phenomenon of bird migration. So, for example, they thought that swallows used to hibernate in mud at the bottom of ponds. Presumably, they thought storks did something similar. But that cycle evolved over millions of years, that the birds would flee cold Europe and then return in the springtime. We're seeing shifts in that now, and climate change seems to be driving it, because quite a few storks, a growing number in fact, in places like Spain and Portugal, they're choosing not to migrate at all. They're staying there all winter long. Migration's a risky business. They do it because they need to find food. But if the climate conditions are suitable, they can stay there year-round, have access to unfrozen water and fields, find rodents and frogs year-round. There's no need for them to migrate and go through that stress. So quite a few of them are staying in Iberia, where it's becoming warmer. But not just that. We're also seeing it happening in places as far north as the Netherlands and in France and in Germany, where a small but growing population of these birds are choosing not to migrate at all. Some of them have become dependent on human handouts. They're thinking, thinking, oh, well, we can get food from these humans. There's no point in us migrating. But it's a sign, though, that the climate is shifting. When you see these changes happening in such a short period of time, it's just happened over the last couple of decades, after millions of years of it being the other way, that definitely gives cause for concern and would also then lead to maybe problems for the species down the line. Because what would happen if many of them stayed behind and then all of a sudden there was a sudden cold spell or there was a disaster? The population could be wiped out in an area. So it's a concern as well as perhaps a benefit for the storks.
At least here in Rustedt, the storks have continued to follow their species migratory tradition, arriving back in the village each spring, repairing and adding new sticks to the existing rooftop nests, laying and incubating eggs, and then feeding their hungry offspring. A female will lay anywhere from 1 to 7 eggs each season, with 4 being the typical number.
I don't know if you've noticed, the nests actually grow in height, because every year the storks put a layer of nesting material on top of it.
Like an extension.
Yeah, sort of. Do you know?
The stork extension. It only goes upwards. Does it go outwards as well? Or do they have
it does, but actually it's really more that
it's
way.
It's more
but
upwards.
But sometimes you can also see that they build against the wind, and then you can see that one side is sort of denser than the other side
of
the
nest. They're not fools. They've been at this for a long time.
Yeah, that's true.
They know how to build
their nest.
They're much more successful than the black stork. This is the white stork we're talking about.
Yeah, but the black stork, you know, it's a lot more secretive and actually doesn't roost anywhere near
like
people.
This, of course,
it roosts
but
in...
But this bird does, and it's been successful.
Yeah.
It's survived.
Yeah.
And the numbers, I think, are doing okay at the moment, aren't they?
They are doing okay, but really only okay. They are not thriving. So we had years when the numbers were growing and thriving, and there is an overall tendency. I've learned this at a conference last year. An overall tendency in northeastern Europe for numbers to slightly drop.
Yeah.
And it's the same for Rustedt. So we've... this year we have 31 breeding pairs, and that is comparably a fairly low number, really. We had 45 in the past, and also the number of young storks drop. And at the moment we've got 2 different figures, so I'm not quite sure which one to go with. Around 40 young storks we have, and again, that is not brilliant. They say in order to keep the population stable, you need to have, on average, 2.2 young storks per breeding couple, and we are way below that. It's not great, and it's probably a result of the dry periods that we had, and we haven't had, for a few years now, we haven't had any proper spring floodings, and that's normally what brings in water and fills in the pools and the wetlands. And they are all dry now, so there isn't really much in terms of frogs or
And do you think that's down to climate change, global warming?
Yeah, guess so, definitely, yeah.
Storks like to nest in secure, elevated locations that are close to open, short-cropped fields, marshes and wetlands. This is one of the key reasons why Rustedt makes such an attractive breeding location. But summer on a German rooftop with no shelter from the blazing sun can be punishingly hot. Birds are unable to sweat, so it is common to see storks with their bills agape, panting in an effort to cool down. If panting doesn't quite cut it, however, the storks have evolved a rather more surprising, not to mention unsavoury, method of reducing their body temperatures.
Storks are very beautiful and elegant birds. But
they are.
Absolutely, but there's certainly one factor of their lifestyle that we humans would find much less attractive. Certainly not the most beautiful part of them. They have to keep cool, and birds are unable to sweat. So on a hot day, you and I, we would sweat, and this might be unpleasant, but it's a way for us to remove excess heat. Birds can't do that. So many birds, what they have to do is then they have to fly into water to bathe and cool their skin down that way. That wastes energy, however, and when you're on the ground or in the water, you're more vulnerable to predators. So storks, and almost uniquely among birds, certain types of vulture do this too, but they're the only ones. What they actually do is they defecate on their own legs. So very often, if they're standing up on a rooftop or in the nest, you see this white wash of, you know, come dripping down from there, and that's what they've done. They've defecated on their own legs. This then dries in the sun and extracts the heat as it's going. So they use the heat from their own bodies to sort of evaporate the liquid, and that's how they
Are they definitely defecating on themselves now.
Absolutely.
100%.
100%. And if you think of that product as being the same as sweat, so sweat goes onto our skin and then the heat of our body then evaporates that and it's lost out into the air. That's exactly what they're doing with their own excrement. Bird excrement is much more liquid than human excrement. What a pleasant conversation this is. So that's what they're doing. And it's a very effective way for them to do that. So of course they have such long legs too that there's a great surface area for them there to lose the heat through. So that's how they keep cool. And to us it seems very unpleasant, but for them it makes great sense. It means they can stay up in their nest, they can stay safe on the rooftops or on the platforms without running into danger. And it's very effective. Now, of course, it may be not so pleasant for the humans below who see all of this whitewash running down their roofs or dripping down, but that's the way nature works. The storks don't care what we think about them, and evolution doesn't care either. It's a very efficient mechanism for them to, I suppose, overcome the disadvantage of not being able to sweat.
It's true that the sloping roofs below each of the stork nests in Rustedt have all been thoroughly whitewashed by the birds, but the humans who share the village with them don't seem to mind. In fact, they encourage the birds to nest there in the first place, as Carla explains.
There were always a few nests in the area. I know from my village, which I said was smaller even, they used to have in the 1970s, they had 9 nests there and there's only one left now. So here too, they were, I think after the war, there were 5 or 7 nests, and then it gradually built up. And it's really because of a group of young men in the 1970s who were active and who defied like health and safety, and they just climbed on rooftops. And I mean, now we've got this hydraulic lift, but back then they really did it all like...
So when you say they went onto the rooftops, they put platforms on top of the roofs, flat platforms, so the birds could have a place to nest.
That's right.
So if the birds didn't have those platforms,
they'd still roost.
They'd still build the nest there, but it'd be a little unstable.
Not necessarily, but yeah, the idea is to give it more stability.
Right.
But it doesn't necessarily mean that they are more stable, really, because the roof construction will eventually rot as well, so that would have to be replaced. And that's, for instance, one of the jobs that the Stork Club do. They every March they go around with the hydraulic lift and check on the roof, on the nests, check for stability. Sometimes, I guess the stork isn't stupid. We know now already that it has started to settle in areas in Germany where there weren't any storks before. So a lot more of the southwest part of Germany now has breeding storks, and they are quite happy and surprised, really. So that's it's a shift, I guess. It doesn't necessarily mean that they'll die out here in Germany, but they'll they look for different and probably better areas to breed.
Right across the European Stork Villages network, from Spain to Poland and from Switzerland to Greece, local people go to similar lengths to help their avian neighbours. In many European cultures, it is considered good luck to have storks nesting on your property. And people deliberately place old wagon wheels and other platforms on posts and rooftops to encourage the birds to build their nests. The network was first established in 1994. And in each of the 15 countries where it operates, local people must demonstrate that they take special care of their stork populations. In turn, their communities are officially recognised as special cultural and natural heritage sites, promoting tourism and unlocking European funding for conservation and awareness efforts. In a way, the European Stork Villages Network is a celebration of international cooperation and shared heritage right across a continent that, until recently, was all too frequently torn apart by strife.
Hello, skipper. Hello, navigator. Half a minute to go. Okay, thanks for that. Okay, keep weaving, Tim. A lot of surf sides and fighter flares, skipper.
Yeah, keep on.
Okay, boys, okay. Hello, bombardier. Okay, when you are.
Bomb doors open.
Bomb doors open, bombardier.
Right.
In the 1930s and 40s, Europe underwent an unprecedented trauma. The outbreak of the Second World War brought misery and suffering to millions, as cities, towns, and villages were devastated. We often focus on the human cost of war, quite understandably. But what about the toll that warfare takes on the natural world?
all wars are absolutely tragic, and of course it's the human casualties of those wars that we should be most concerned about first and foremost. But we also need to recognise that there are huge environmental consequences as well, and a lot of different species have suffered both in Europe and in many other countries in the world because of warfare. And the white stork is a very good example of that. White storks, of course, they nest in towns and in villages and on the edges of cities. And during the Second World War, many of those nesting sites and the towns were completely destroyed or very, very badly damaged, which, of course, was a tragedy for the people living there, but also removed a lot of the habitat that those birds needed to nest. But the situation was even worse than that for the storks, because obviously not every village or town in Germany or in other parts of Europe were destroyed. There's plenty of rural areas where the birds still could survive. But what the war did was it led to a massive and very rapid increase in infrastructure. The more power lines went up, there was a huge intensification of farming, munitions factories, all sorts of work for the war effort. And this led to lots of pesticides in the environment. It led to more power lines that storks would collide with. That was a very significant problem for them. And it's now recognised that it was actually the Second World War that was the catalyst for the massive decline in white storks occurred, particularly in Central and in Eastern Europe. When we look at the stork population of Germany at the time, first of all, we have to recognise that what we call Germany today has very different borders to the Germany of that time. Germany was a much larger country then than it is now, and through acquisitions during the war and annexations of other countries, it took over what's today Austria, much of what is Poland, areas that are part of Russia, Ukraine. These kind of areas were all under German control. So when we look at stork populations then, we have to consider that German ornithologists were looking at those birds as well. But we do see that there was a decrease probably in the magnitude of 70 to 75% in the white stork, not immediately during the war itself, but in the decade or so after it. And that decline continued up until around the 1990s, when all of a sudden through conservation measures and through efforts to reintroduce the bird in certain parts of Europe, like in Italy and in Switzerland, the tides started to turn and the bird became more common again. So it's taken a long time for it to get back to the sort of levels it was before the Second World War. One thing, though, that was important at that time was the role that the country formerly known as East Germany played in that, because East Germany was really a repository for storks where they disappeared from most of West Germany. And they've been gradually, slowly but surely, from that population, repopulating the rest of Central and Eastern Europe. The population in Poland has recovered very, very well. The species went completely extinct in Switzerland. It has been reintroduced there and has worked very, very well. Population went as low as just one pair left in all of the Netherlands after the war. They've started to recover there now as well. So it's good to see that the destruction wrought by the war on the ecosystem for the white stork has been rectified in many ways. It is a success story that that bird has come back from the brink, and it was recognised just in time that it was in serious trouble. The history of the white stork when it comes to the Second World War is quite interesting as well. There was a very strange plan around 1942 where Heinrich Himmler, on behalf of the German government, he had the plan to try and contact the Boers in South Africa and to get messages for them to support the war effort and lend their support and their finances to Germany. And the way that he wanted to do this was to fix messages to the legs of storks that would then migrate to Southern Africa and would transport this information with them. Now, that plan was actually pretty quickly scuppered. People realised, because they were informed by ornithologists, that the actual return rate for those birds would be very, very low. You might have only maybe one recovery for every few hundred birds that were released. So they decided it wasn't cost-effective or worth the effort. But it's interesting that the white stork very nearly played a role in the Second World War itself, unwittingly. And it's really because of the devastation that happened during the Second World War and its aftermath to towns and villages, but also to the ecosystem and the general countryside, that led to the formation of the European Stork Village Network. The idea was that birds transcend boundaries, and countries that formerly had been enemies or had been sources of terrible suffering and strife could use something like a bird to bring them back together, and it would be a symbol of rebirth. And what better bird for that than the stork? It's always been associated with birth and with renewal. It's a migrant as well. It brings hope. And so it's no coincidence that this is the bird that was chosen. And then, of course, because of its association with villages, it was a way also to benefit local people, show life returning to normal, and to show that after the war and after all the destruction and suffering that happened, that normal life could return. And that's really the legacy, I suppose, of the White Stork Village project, which is still going strong today. It's linking multiple countries across Europe, countries that were formerly at each other's throats and that suffered greatly. And the stork has been a real symbol of that rebirth and survival.
So there are by now 15 villages that are joined in this network. And Rühstedt was the second village. So per country, one village gets this recognition. You have to have a stork population, but you also you have to have people within the village that really care for the
volunteers.
Storks, mostly, yeah. So that if these conditions are given, then you can apply to become a stork village.
So, and what do you get in return when you become? Do you get a grant? Do you get some money? Do you get some help?
Yes, we did get quite a few grants to, firstly, to help restoring the nests and checking on the nests regularly. But we also had some grants to do work in the countryside, to create new puddles, new areas.
And I know some people have reconstructed wetlands for the birds, haven't they?
That's right, yeah. There is no point in having rooftops where the birds can nest if you don't have the proper
food
supply.
Yeah, you need it. Yeah. You need the proper habitat.
Absolutely. So there is a saying here, wer Störche möchte, muss für Frösche sorgen, which means those who want storks, they have to supply frogs as well.
And what kind of frog do you have here? Do you know which is it? The Rana Temporaria? Is it the common frog? The blue frog?
Yeah. Oh, the blue frog is exists here. The one that only turns blue in April. Yeah, yeah, we've got that one.
It turns that colour during the mating season.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is not good for the blue frog, I wouldn't have thought, because surely the storks can see it easier then, can it? Is that true?
I don't know, really.
Probably,
maybe so, I don't know. But then we've got the red-bellied toad here as well. I know that just because it's such a peculiar sound that you can hear when cycling along the dike.
It's only in the past couple of centuries that we humans have really begun to understand the phenomenon of bird migration. As recently as the 18th century, for example, it was widely believed that swallows spent the winter in hibernation in mud at the bottom of lakes. That seemed the most rational explanation for the sudden vanishing act performed by them each autumn, followed by their abrupt reappearance in the spring. White storks were also famous for their own sudden annual disappearance once the breeding season had ended. Nobody knew for sure where they went, though on very rare occasions, some rather gruesome evidence would present itself. There are multiple records of storks returning to their nesting quarters in Europe impaled by arrows that had passed right through their bodies and become lodged. These arrows looked quite unlike any typically used by hunters in Europe, and that's because they were fired at the birds by tribal hunters in Africa. Skilled though many of the African marksmen were, sometimes a direct hit failed to prove fatal. Vital organs intact, the occasional lucky survivor would continue its migration as normal, returning to Europe, pierced through by the arrow. The Germans even have a name for these birds, Pfeilstork, or arrow storks. And to date, no fewer than 25 have been documented. The most famous was found in 1822, near a village called Klutz, in the very north of Germany. It was stuffed, and to this day, remains on display in the zoological collection of the University of Rostock, the African arrow still piercing its neck. Arrows are but one of the hazards facing storks during migration. Migration is such a risky business that, as we heard earlier, a growing number of storks are choosing to give it up altogether. Climate change and habitat loss have drastically reshaped the environment upon which storks depend. And the simple fact is that today, they have more inhospitable desert and more unpredictable weather to deal with. For a small but growing number, the benefits of migration no longer outweigh the disadvantages. Storks are large, heavy birds, and flying long distances by flapping massive wings is not a very energy-efficient way to cover long distances. They prefer to travel by soaring on thermals, columns of rising air that form when the ground is heated by the sun, in much the same way that vultures, eagles, and other large birds of prey do. They use the rising air to lift their bodies high into the sky on motionless, outstretched wings. Then, when sufficiently high, they glide onwards, losing height as they do so, until they reach the next thermal, where the whole process begins again. It is a rather slow way to travel, but crucially, it requires very little effort. The problem is that thermals only form over land, not over water. This means that storks and other large soaring birds have great difficulty crossing wide expanses of water, most importantly, the Mediterranean Sea. The solution is to concentrate at the very shortest crossing points, the Straits of Gibraltar between Spain and Morocco, and the Bosphorus Straits in Turkey, where the gap between continents is just a few kilometres at most. Virtually all of Europe's migrating white storks congregate at one of these two points each autumn, streaming across the narrow stretches of water when weather conditions are right and flapping can be kept to a minimum. In the past, the fact that storks would, without fail, concentrate at these well-known bottlenecks each autumn proved extremely tempting to hunters. Before departing Europe, the birds would generally be soaring at altitude, out of range of most guns. But by the time they had made it to the other side of the straits, with no thermals having kept them aloft over the water, gravity ensured that they were flying much lower, making them much easier targets for hunters. The following spring, as the birds returned north to their breeding grounds, the same drama would play out in reverse, with the birds now easy prey for gunmen on the European side of the Mediterranean. Thankfully, wildlife protection laws are much stricter today, and although some illegal killing of storks does still occur, it no longer impacts the population in such a serious way. So we're looking across now, and we're looking at this outhouse. We've got the old building, which you thought was a pigsty, and there's a nest there, and there are two chicks on that. Yeah. So that's a good turnout there. And then behind that, to the left, you have another longer building. Again, looks like an outhouse, a barn, but a larger barn, maybe for storing grain or whatever. Oh, one stork has just come off there. God, they're beautiful in flight, aren't they? Yes. And you've got one, two, three, four. So if you can picture the scene with this red brick building, and it's got big barn doors on it and barn windows, you can imagine what they're like, and it's got a slate roof, and along the slate roof it looks like it has from end to end four chimneys along the top of it, and on top of each of those chimneys, in inverted commas, we have platforms, and on those platforms are huge nests, which you reckon can weigh up to 2 tonnes, as you were saying to me earlier.
That's right.
And we've got two storks on two of the nests, and the other two are vacant for the moment. And beyond that, we've another stork. I mean, everywhere you look, because we can see the tops of all the buildings, because it's very low rise, nothing more than 2 stories in this little village, apart from the kirk. And you can see right all across all the rooftops, and all you can see are beautiful stork nests and storks on them. It's extraordinary.
And it's a fabulous place here, actually, on this balcony, especially in the evening, because then the storks come fly in for the last feed, and you can hear all the young ones making really funny sounds. They kind of call because they know they're going to be fed in a moment. So it's a great view.
Now, when you say they call, is it a racket or is it a song?
It's a racket, definitely.
What does it sound like? Come on, don't be shy. It's radio.
It's a funny sound. Yeah.
So are the parents regurgitating up the food?
Yes, they are. A stork itself hasn't got teeth in its beak, so it can only swallow things whole, really.
So it can't hold
things. So it will swallow it, and it'll keep it in its throat, and then it'll come to the nest. And you can, if you've got a really good set of binoculars, you can see what's coming out of their beak. And you can see that it's basically opening the beak, and the young ones then try to fetch things out of their beak with their own beaks and pull things out, and sometimes they drop it into the nest. Hang on, I just want to point out, there is a stork which has landed on the roof, and I bet it's the adult stork, because the other two, you can see from how they are positioned in the nest, they are pointing their beaks into the nest and their bums outwards, so they are feeding just now.
Ah.
And I'm guessing it's the adult who either brought in some food or the other adult has already left again, but anyway, it's getting too crowded in the nest, so it had enough and just leaves the young ones to feed.
Are they very mild-mannered creatures?
No, hang on. I think that's what we make up. They are not mild-mannered at all. And actually, I think some people are sometimes quite shocked, like my mom is. She always liked to think of these birds as, oh, they are so kind and whatnot. They are not. For instance, storks killing their young ones when they can tell they won't. Let's say they've got two or three storks in a nest, two or three babies, and they can tell there isn't enough food around. They kill one of them, maybe two of them, or else they would just chuck them out of the nest. And that is to make sure that they get at least one of their young ones through. So that's nature, and it's not exactly mannered, but and it's to watch it, it's quite heartbreaking, but that is nature, and they know what they do, so that's something that we have to accept. Also, they fight a lot amongst each other. They fight a lot. So it is actually, we always think that they like to breed in colonies, but that's not necessarily the case. So sometimes there are villages where there is one stork, like our neighbor village, Belo. The stork there is so territorial, it won't allow another stork in the area.
So, for example, you would never find a building like we have in front of us here with four nests on it.
In Belo.
So that's four different families.
No, definitely not. And actually, there used to be, there is a famous picture and poster with five nests on that roof. And there was so much fighting that really the eggs suffered, the young ones suffered. So eventually it was decided to take nests down. So they took three nests down and left only those two on the chimneys. And the storks wanted to build there. So they did build a wired nest. So without any platform, they tried to build on either end.
Yeah, I should say these rooftops are pointed.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
and
the
still,
rooftops are not flat. It's the platform that has been erected that's flat. But the stork would still build a nest there.
Exactly. Yes. So they are, if they've chosen a place they and they want to breed there, they will. And they manage to. Yeah, definitely. And also there are some tin roofs as well. So then things
with corrugated
slide off
iron.
There. Yeah, that's right. Like that one over there, actually, in the far distance. And that nest that you can see on the right-hand side, that slid down last year just with two young storks in it. The storks died, the baby storks, and the nest just totally collapsed. And yet, within the same season, the two adult storks rebuilt the nest because they just wanted to have a nest there.
Well, talk to me about the Stork Club, because you're a member of the Stork Club.
Yes, I am a member of the Stork Club, and the Stork Club has around about 80 members. They are not all from the area here. And so one of the main tasks of the Stork Club is to see to the stork nests. That's really one of the biggest tasks of the Stork Club. That's really checking that all the nests are in order, are stable, are not too tall, and also take material out, like I said, plastics and ropes and stuff. And also, because it's very dense, and what you can't tell when you look at a nest from here, it's really flat on the top. You would think, oh, it's a nice little dent or so. It's not, actually. It's really pretty damn flat on the top. And it's very dense. It's full of food rests, like little bones, little stuff, pellets as well. And it's all very condensed. And so in springtime, that we take a rake and just rake it up a bit to allow more drainage.
So why did you get interested in storks?
I've always loved storks. I've also always loved cranes. And this area is just full of them. And I just find it amazing to be so close to them and that they are just part of your life here.
But did you study ornithology or science at all?
No, not at all. No, I've just read a lot and gone to congresses and just out of personal interest, really.
So pure love.
Yeah, you could say that, yeah.
So you lived abroad, I take it, for a while, did you?
Yes, I used to live in Sheffield for 12, 13 years. Yeah, and I've now lived here for six years in the area. And I love it, and I wouldn't change it for the world.
No, I don't blame you. It's a wonderful little village. It's a wonderful sight to behold.
Yeah.
And it's terrific to get so close to nature. And such a wild creature, and the fact that you're maintaining that wildness, the fact that you're not interfering, you're allowing these birds to do what they do naturally, is a credit to everybody here and in the Stork Club, and indeed to all of the people who work and volunteer in the European Stork Villages program.
Yeah, I mean, it takes a lot of commitment, really, from people who do this work voluntarily and also people who live in the village, because it's not always the most pleasant of things to have, like, stork muck on your veranda or on your terrace or so. And so you have to put up with some things. You have to clean your gutter more regularly and all sorts of things. So, and not to forget that people are getting older in these villages, and there aren't that many young people who stay behind because they all want to work, find good jobs, want to move to bigger cities. That also, I guess, makes it a bit harder for people to get engaged here because the age structure is shifting, so it's not so easy here.
As the community of Rustedt has proven, local pride, increased awareness and a willingness to make allowances for nature can go a long way towards saving a species. The white stork is once again a common and familiar sight in villages across Europe, and even appears to be expanding its range. A pair nested in England this summer, for the first time in over 600 years. Could they also begin breeding here in Ireland? Niall Hatch of Birdwatch Ireland.
If the effects of climate change continue, and we're already seeing many storks, an increasing number, choosing not to migrate at all. We're also seeing the range expanding, though. So southern England, for example, has now got the climate conditions that seem to be suitable for storks. They're showing initial signs of perhaps colonising southern Britain. If climate change continues, we may well see that happening here in Ireland. We saw a similar thing happen in the mid to late 90s with a bird called the little egret, which breeds in wetlands. It arrived, started breeding around Youghal, and now is a common bird in many parts of Ireland, breeding widely here. We're starting to see it happening with another bird called the spoonbill, which isn't breeding here in Ireland yet, but which is turning up in increasing numbers on the southern coast. These were birds that were very much associated with the Mediterranean, with warm weather. The stork may follow a similar pattern, and who knows, in a few more years, we might have the phenomenon of storks nesting on rooftops and around buildings in Ireland. What we know about these birds is that they're not shy of humans. They tend to seek out human places to nest. They love towns, they love villages. And the landscape in Ireland, if you fast forward maybe three or four decades, could be very, very different from a climate point of view and therefore from a bird point of view as well.
But how will they affect the ecosystem?
Well, that's an unknown question. They would certainly come into competition with some other birds that we have. So in terms of the ecosystem that they currently fill in other parts of Europe, they compete directly with certain birds of prey, like buzzards, which would feed on frogs and prey like that too. They compete with herons in relation to wetland prey. They compete with owls in relation to things like mice in fields. So it could have a knock-on effect for those birds and for mammals as well. It could conceivably affect things like foxes. But the big thing, of course, is that we don't know. These systems are so complex and evolve and develop over millions of years that when you add a new piece to the jigsaw puzzle or take it away, it can have a dramatic effect on the overall appearance of the whole natural picture. So, again, it's just speculation, really, but if this bird does come to Ireland, it will have some effect. Could be good, could be bad, we just don't know.
Would you welcome the stork to Ireland?
Well, certainly it would be nice to see them here, but I would be disappointed that what has caused this has been the human caused climate change and the effect that we've had on our environment. When we see these changes happening, it's not good. Storks really shouldn't be here in Ireland. Or if they were going to be, it's something that should evolve, you know, over millions of years or thousands of years as the climate naturally shifts. So it could be a bird that we would have been on the cards to get in a few centuries' time with natural climate change. But if it's happening immediately, that's not good news. Obviously, what I do think about too is that Ireland, given its position at the very edge of Europe, we are the last port of call for many birds. We are finding birds that will be using Ireland as a last refuge, the last sort of area that they can breed in before the climate zone takes them out into the Atlantic where there's no land. So it could be a fact that this species may be saved by coming to Ireland. That we probably won't know that for a long time to come yet, but we are seeing these shifts in range across Europe and changes in migratory behaviour. So I would guess within a few decades they will be here.
And as you say, they're already in the UK. It's only a hop, skip and a jump.
Absolutely. And what we were saying is when things happen in southern England particularly, it usually within 20 years it tends to happen around Wexford, Waterford, Cork. We've seen that with other creatures and other plants as well. So that's something certain to watch out for. So certainly wonderful birds, great to see them here. I don't think they'll cause problems for people. They'll mean a bit of a shifting balance in the ecosystem, but I think we ourselves should think that the effect that we've had on the ecosystem, well, this is a sign of it. And for people who doubt climate change, and I know that's a dwindling number of people, but you have to pay attention to what's happening in the natural world, particularly with migratory birds. They are screaming this warning to us that we are affecting our planet's climate.